I don't know how sound is doing here. Sound doesn't feel good to me. All right, everyone?
You need one more person.
Oh.
There you go. Jim is in the building.
I don't want him to miss my opening day. Whatever that is. A story, yeah. All right, now we're official. Good morning. Welcome to April 14th's meeting. And if anyone really cares other than myself, because I have 200 flats of plants to get in the mud, we've had 4 inches of wonderful rain in April so far this year. And we love our rain, but it's time to stop. Otherwise, I'll be living on the $99 a month thing here pretty quick. What's that?
Up there now.
Oh, don't even say that.
But not happening.
So we'll get started here. But first, I've always felt this board is very, very unique, without a doubt, and very, very special. And we've really become a world board, if you think about it, because the vice chair has just returned from a sojourn to Africa, which she can report on soon. And our board member Singh has just come back from India. So we kind of covered the globe here. And Shalom, have you been on a travel anywhere?
Not today.
No.
I was skiing.
Oh, you went skiing.
I was skiing.
And board member McGrath, he goes to
I went to Treasure Island.
Treasure Island, that's right. I went to Castroville yesterday and picked up our plant, so that was my sojourn. So continue on, welcome, and roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliyahu?
Here.
Mr. McGrath?
I'm here.
Mr. Moore?
Here.
Mr.
Oh, Moore, I'm sorry. It started with an M. It's a figure close enough.
No, Moore, no.
Mr. Schroeder?
Here.
Dr. Singh?
Yes.
Dr. Young?
Yes, here.
Mr. Muller?
Here. I didn't recognize board member Schroeder, but he's been over to Sassoon, so he's kind of traveled a little bit too across the river.
Yeah, right.
So introductions at this time. I don't see Tam. And
I did not see Tam, and right. We have no staff introductions.
Okay, and so we will move on to public forum. And I do have a number of cards, so Amy's going to be here a while, so I'll get David out of the way first. Sorry, Amy. Actually, that way you can contradict what he says or whatever now you want to do.
No. Good morning, members of the board. I'm David Lewis, the executive director of State of Bay. And this morning I'm passing you some material, including our latest newsletter, which on the back features an article about our efforts working with cities to reduce trash now and try to help them reduce things at the front end in anticipation of permit compliance on the stormwater permit. But this morning I want to share with you the growing regional opposition to the proposal I've mentioned to you before to build on salt ponds in Redwood City. Cargill owns this property, about 1,400 acres. They've partnered with DMB Associates, and they're proposing to the city of Redwood City that they build 12,000 homes to house 30,000 people on this property. Now, since the advent of the Clean Water Act and the Environmental Protection Agency, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, there's never been approval for development of housing or any other significant development on a salt pond. That's closing in on 50 years. The Redwood City Council is pursuing this, though, encouraging the developer and preparing to start what will be a long and complex and controversial CEQA process, even though that's actually not required because the proposal is completely inconsistent with the city's own general plan and zoning. It's completely inconsistent with the state's new climate adaptation strategy that says the state should be discouraging development in undeveloped areas that can present the opportunity for habitat restoration, which this property does. But you don't have to take our word for it. There are now more than 100 local elected officials, current and former elected officials, who have written to the Redwood City Council opposing this project. And I've enclosed two examples of that. One is a letter from Jared Huffman, who's the chair of the Assembly Water Parks and Wildlife Committee, and who crafted much of the legislation that the governor signed last year to try to deal with the Delta and water distribution. There's no water in the Hetch Hetchy allocation to Redwood City to support an additional 30,000 residents, or probably even an additional 1,000 on this property. And so the developer is proposing a very complex series of water transfers from Bakersfield, which would involve multiple approvals by agencies. And Assemblymember Huffman, in particular, in his letter, you'll see comments on the inappropriateness of that proposal and his skepticism about it. Now, the second enclosure is a clipping from one of the Menlo Park City Council members who wrote this week in the San Francisco Business Times about why it's not necessary to start a long environmental impact report process on a project that is so out of step and out of scope with the city's own general plan and zoning. So why am I bringing this to your attention? Well, the Regional Water Quality Control Board is one of many agencies that would be required to assess and permit this project if it ever receives local approval from Redwood City. We have met with your staff and brought this to their attention. And what we think is particularly important is at the appropriate time for the board and the board staff to make sure that the city and the project developer understand all of the issues that the Regional Water Board would have to consider so that they can take a hard look at whether they really want to proceed down this costly and expensive and controversial road. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Amy, please.
Good morning, Chairman Mueller, members of the board. My name is Amy Chastain, and I'm here on behalf of the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies. And I just want to share a little bit of good news for you. As you may know, BACWA, on behalf of its member agencies, submitted the second annual mercury mass emissions report on April 1st. And this, just to give you a little background, was required by the Mercury Watershed Report that you approved in 2007. And so BACWA has taken on, with a lot of support from its members, to gather all of the mass emissions data from all of the POTWs in Bay Area, compile it in a report, and this was submitted to the Water Board on April 1st. And the good news is that the loading for this year looks very similar to what we estimated last year. Last year, we didn't have a full 12 months of data. We only had, I think it was 9 months. I could be wrong about that. And we estimated mass emissions at 4.5 kilograms per year. This year, we have a full 12 months of data. You know, it was a lot rainier this year than it has been in the past. And we're looking still at mass emissions of 4.8 kilograms per year, which is really exciting news. The permit limit is 17 kilograms per year, and the final waste load allocation, the TMDL, if I remember correctly, is 11. So this is really promising, and no doubt due to a lot of great efforts, not least of which have been coordinated by the BACWA's Bay Area Pollution Prevention Group, which has undertaken a lot of trainings for member agencies on dental amalgam separator programs and inspection programs for dentist office. So I think it's great news, and we're excited to share that with you, and we're optimistic that we're going to continue to see such great results over the next couple years. And if you want to get a copy of the report, it'll be on the BACWA website as soon as I can get back to my desk and upload it. But I'm also happy to send it via email or send you an electronic version. Thanks for letting me share the news.
Thank you. Those are good news. The two speakers, one not so good news and one some good news. So we just have to hope we have more good news out there. So thank both of you. I have no further cards at the public forum, and so we will move on. There are no minutes in the packet at this time because of the lengthy October 14th meeting. Is that correct?
Right. We're continuing those to next month. That was a lengthy meeting. I'll also report we are working to set up online MP3 recordings of meetings so that we'll have that available for the public, because that's really the bottom line, obviously, of minutes or the approach is make sure the public has information on what transpired at each meeting. So we're trying to come into the 21st century here and see what we can get set up online.
Great. And moving on then to the chair's report, I did have the privilege, along with Board Member McGrath and Schroeder, that Ellen, we were well represented with the executive officer and staff out at the sign or the agreement with the mothball fleet on March 31st, I believe. And it really was a very, very special day, in my opinion, not only for the environment, but for this board. And I kind of felt personally that it was probably one of our larger accomplishments of environmental issues with the water in the bay. I think we've come a long way, and staff has all worked so hard to get that done. And then I continued to stay out there and went out into the water with a number of individuals, and the spirits on those ships are really very special out there. A lot of men at that time were in and out on those ships, whether alive or dead, and so it was a very special special day, and I think it was a great day for all of us, and thank all of you from my perspective quickly. And I got a chuckle out of our public. The public is great, and I don't know if anyone got to read it, and I know people traveling did, but Ghost Fleet fades into history, and so this would have been so much easier, you know, legal staff, you could help us out here, but one of the letters to the editor was, I'm disappointed and saddened that the Victor ships are being scrapped. Death of the Ghost Fleet, April 1st. Can anyone find a way to save these ships? I love it. They are an important part of history. Put them on land and make them into restaurants or hotels along the coast. That's just perfect. So maybe we could talk to the Coastal Commission. We could park a couple in Half Moon Bay. I tease my fishing. So people from all over the world would stay there and help pay for their upkeep. I say, don't scrap them. Good job. So I thought you'd get a kick out of that one there. So, but we're doing the right thing. And the other one was, I don't know if everyone noticed, but the governor has appointed a new Delta Council. And the members on the Delta Council, from my perspective, just knowing a couple of them, are excellent quality of individuals. I think they have a job that they'll probably, I don't think, could ever solve, but at least they're going to try. I don't know if you've got to see who they are, Jerry. You know who they are. So, interesting group is right. So, I think that's all I have to report at this time. So, I will go to the vice chair.
I don't have anything to report at this time. The other side of the world is alive and well and kicking and fun to visit. It doesn't have a lot to do with the kinds of problems we encounter here. They're so different.
Can you drink the water?
You cannot drink the water.
Oh, cannot drink the water.
Absolutely. You don't even want to put your toe in the water.
Uh-oh. Looks like they need a board over there then, huh?
They have a different set of issues.
Good. We'll keep moving down that way, Dr. Singh.
Well, I'm back from India, and I'm alive and well, so I caught malaria over there. I was advised by the doctor to take malaria pill, but I ventured without it. But weakness continues. But one thing amazing, I stayed in my village in a very remote area for 3 days, and electricity has not made it there yet. But then I found that I had a cell phone and I like to charge it. And in the village, there is no electricity, although they have laid down the columns and wires, and they are apparently bringing electricity sometime soon. Then I found a revolution in the solar energy. In the villages, almost when I was born over there, most of the homes were thatched homes. Now most of the homes are made of bricks and plaster and slabs. So apparently there is improvement. The road is over there. It is connected to the city. The school used to be elementary school. Now it is a middle school over there. I found some progress. And then I found many people have solar panels on their roof. And I got a lot of places I can charge my cell phone because they have solar panels. But more than that, one amazing invention in India, it cost only $10, called D-Light. I don't know why they call it D-Light. It should be night light. This is a small little lantern, and you put in the daytime, there is a little tiny panel on the top in the sun. It lights you whole night. You turn it on the medium light, but if you want to study or some students are studying the books, then it can last for 4 hours in bright light. And it only costs $10. And I found a revolution that almost every home has this D-Light for $10. And it's powered by solar. I don't know. I put solar energy in my home. My bill, PG&E bill, used to run in San Jose $400 a month in winter time. Last month, I found my bill to be $17. I spent about $21,000. And that was after a state rebate. They charged me the bill. They put 32 panels on my roof in San Jose. And then I did my income tax return. I got $6,500 from federal government's credit for the solar energy. So my cost is less than $15,000. But my last month PG&E bill was $17. So I think you guys may consider, if you can afford upfront cost, I didn't finance, I paid in cash, but you can finance it. It is a good deal to do. Go. That's all I'll say. Otherwise, I don't want to take all the time here. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Schroeder?
Other than traveling across the straits to Yosemite from my hometown of Martinez, I did spend last week in Yosemite Valley, and it snowed on us, and it rained on us, and there's lots and lots of clean water.
You could drink the water. Very good. And Shalom?
Nothing.
I've got three things. One, a funny thing. Talking about boats, Wally Abernathy, who was executive director of the Port of Oakland before I started there, bought the Potomac. And later the Golden Bear was there. And Wally bought the Potomac, which was one of the historic ships, for $25,000, and more than $10 million later, he says, no good deeds. And so the old saw in the sailing business is the two happiest days in a sailor's life are the day he buys a boat and the day he sells it. Two things. Yesterday was the first meeting of the EPA Alumni Association, and I was remiss in not getting Terry notice of that. But it was very interesting. There were about 100 people gathered in Washington, D.C., including the first two administrators of EPA, Bill Ruckelshaus and Russell Train. And I just want to give a perspective on what we're part of, because I think it is truly momentous. Bill Ruckelshaus was only 37 years old when he was appointed to the regional administrator. EPA was a brand new agency. He was a moderate Republican. He'd been successful in the legislature in Indiana. He had helped draft the Clean Air Act in Indiana, and he had run against Birch Bayh and lost. Went right into the Nixon administration and was pulled into EPA. It's a remarkable kind of accomplishment. One of the things that he pointed out yesterday was that the only bill of the 10 or so environmental bills that Nixon vetoed was the Clean Water Act, which was overridden. And I looked up the numbers this morning. I can't remember the House number. It was 237 to 26 or something like that. And the Senate number was 52 to 12. Bipartisan override. Reagan also vetoed the Clean Water Act in 87, I believe, and was also overridden by a huge margin. At the time he started, one-third of the cities in the United States had no treatment, none at all. And it's been a long time since I tried to recapture it. I was a college student when I started in the EPA. We've been down a road, and he talked about, clearly you couldn't make the water fishable and swimmable in the first set of deadlines with all the money in the federal government, but how you start those huge tasks is one step at a time, and you solve a problem, and then you go along. So I found it very inspirational. And then the last thing I want to comment on is the Estuary newsletter, where it talked about trestles and apparently some activities by some of the rail companies to replace those trestles with similar trestles that constrict the mouths. And I think that's a very important issue for us as we go forward and as we try to cope with sea level rise. A constriction in the lower part of a stream is going to pose severe and increased flooding as sea level rise. So this is something I'd like the staff to think about, whether or not there's some way we can have some jurisdiction and maybe begin to look at a combination of regulatory and incentive system to begin to manage those streams so that we can do a better job of protecting the habitat that's there and make sure that the risks of flooding don't get worse that people don't claim that having done something to a stream or a watershed system, they have a vested right to maintain it forever, because I just can't see that as being good public policy.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair?
I have a footnote to add. On the Estuary News, there is also an article, in case you folks missed it, about riparian, it's titled Riparian Vegetation at Risk, and it talks about the Corps of Engineers' continuing requirements that there be no vegetation on levees, and the quotes from this board, help me with her name.
I think it was Ann Riley.
It was.
Yeah.
Ms. Riley, were excellent, and I thought captured our sense that we can do a lot better about bringing the science of managing the levees into the 21st century and get a lot of good habitat and also natural flood control. And I wanted to just compliment the board staff at doing a good job and, you know, keep up the effort, because it looks on the face of it like the Corps still needs a little bit of bringing along on this issue. And I imagine it's a huge headache.
Well, and similar to the trestle issue, this is something on our radar that we're trying to push against, but much like we found on the mothball fleet, there's sometimes a movable object, so it's and the railroads and federal government are probably up there in the list of immovable objects, but we're going to continue to push on it.
Well, just to tag on to that a little bit, I think we have to be careful on throwing stones, because our own water board issues in neighboring regions, not this great region of ours, with food safety. I mean, we've all worked so hard with buffer zones and swales and cover crops, and now they're wanting us to strip them, and it's just absurd in our opinion. And so, I mean, that's very contradictory of what we've all been trained and wanting to do. And then all of a sudden, just because there's been some, you know, issues out there, they're saying, well, no, you can't have any habitat along your fields anymore in case. Yeah, just for a little humor in the story, if you could imagine myself in humor, but last August, the inspectors came up to Juicy Farms, and they grow Brussels sprouts, and their great-grandfather grew Brussels sprouts, and they had wooden platforms they stand on, and they all have to be stainless steel now, and stainless steel, whatever. But the biggest comic of the day was you're not allowed to have cats in a barn anymore either. So here comes Oreo out, and he's out there giving it this out there with the inspectors, and Johnny's there like, not my cat. I don't know whose cat it is. And this guy's rubbing against everybody. It's like, okay, Oreo, you're in trouble. Get out of here. So I don't know how far we can push it, but if you can't have a cat in a barn, my God, history is gone in our lives, because we all have cats in our barns and houses and wherever. But, I mean, got to be some common sense put into this. So I think Oreo's still around the barn. He hasn't gone anywhere, but I went down to pick up sprouts for the Ritz the other day, and Oreo's still in the barn. The Ritz hasn't complained yet, so. All right, so sorry about that, but that's how far it's gone, and really the core of what, it's absurd. So our executive officer was gone on civic duty, so congratulations and thank you, and thanks staff for covering while you were out there to do your duty. And, you know, I always remember the story about rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6, right? So thank you for your duty. So go for it, executive officer. Yeah.
A few things. A couple I wanted to note that are in the executive officer's report. One, US EPA did approve the PCB TMDL that you adopted back about 2 years ago. We did not expect a problem there, but it's always a challenge to go from your approval to state board approval. Actually, you adopt, state board approves, Office of Administrative Law needs to approve, and then it goes to US EPA. But I think the important aspect, as we noted in that item, is that We're not waiting for all of those approvals to go through. We're trying to do early implementation actions. And I think even what Amy mentioned on Mercury demonstrates some of the early implementation actions, because we were working with the wastewater community on what they could do to address their mercury discharge through pollution prevention even before all the approvals went through. And PCBs is a similar action. But it also demonstrates that things that you do don't get rubber stamped the next day. They do have to go through a process. Also good news in there, again, it takes some time, but the transfer, official transfer of the remaining 40 acres at Point Malotti in Richmond from the Navy to the city finally taking place after a number of steps that you did had to go through the governor's office. And so we're pleased to see that move forward. Certainly many things that go on in Richmond are hot potatoes, and this is still controversial, especially the proposal there to put in a casino. But our concern obviously is with the remaining cleanup, and we feel that will move forward. I will note that we will have revised cleanup order coming to you in a couple of months for Point Malotti. A couple of other items. We're in that period on budget, sort of between the governor's proposal, which initially comes out in January, and then there's what they call the May revise, where updated income projections allow some tinkering with the governor's proposal. In between is the period where the legislature, through the budget committees in both the Assembly and Senate, review the proposals. The State Board, which we're part of, is having its budget reviewed. There are a couple of budget change proposals in there, including some that would shift some of our funding from general fund into fees, which we feel would be a good thing. So that's moving through slowly. There's no significant change to the proposals that the governor has made. There is ongoing, as you've probably seen in the press, ongoing legal action relative to the furloughs. At this point, the action that appeals court took this week looks like it locks in furloughs to continue up through June 30th. So we're still going to be on furlough for the first three Fridays of each month through the end of June. But it's sort of a stay tuned type of thing, because now the courts are looking at this, and things may change. But we still are operating under the direction that we will need to have 10% salary savings in the coming fiscal year, which means we would need to keep about 10% of our positions open, and we're not there yet. So it means essentially we're not able to hire, and we're limited on our ability to promote. So we're trying to live within that. I'll note, as you saw in your emails, that the May WQCC was postponed because of the concerns over the expense of that budget. And there are proposals to have some webinars or other online covering that. I haven't seen anything concrete other than that proposal, and I know Jim was on part of the committee of that, and I don't know if you've heard anything new, but at this point any WQCC would probably then be off until the fall. So stay tuned on that. Finally, I will note that as part of our enforcement report that we have in each monthly report, last month we reported that in February the board's prosecution team issued 47 administrative civil liability complaints for late annual industrial stormwater reports. Three of those were withdrawn, leaving 44. And of that 44, 19 have been settled at this point, where they've fully paid the proposed assessment in the complaint. Nine others have waived their right to a hearing within 90 days. Which means that there's either settlement discussions or that at some point down the road we'll bring that to you for consideration. And then there are 16 dischargers who have not responded either through waiving their right to a hearing or indicating that they're going to pay the liability. That puts a challenge on this board because they have the right to a hearing. In fact, they're required to have a hearing within 90 days if they haven't waived. And so that means that unless these 16 or any number of those 16 do request a waiver or otherwise pay their liability, we will need to have 16 hearings in May. So we're monitoring this. The prosecution team is keeping me informed as any changes, but that means we will potentially need to have many hearings on this at the May meeting and possibly schedule Thursday, May 13th, the next day, as a board meeting to consider all of these. So I will keep you posted as we get ready to mail out the May agenda, but this is sort of a worst case because we're optimistic that some of these parties will wake up, especially when they see their names on the agenda. They finally realize that this is serious and pay attention to it. But at this point, we must plan for the worst case.
What's our average fee? It's kind of a general idea of what we're talking about for the...
My recollection is that the complaints went out for a range from about $2,500 up to
$11,000-$12,000. Okay.
Through the chair, if it is necessary to constitute a subcommittee of the board or some such structure to have the hearing, would we have to take any action today or could we do that at the next board meeting?
We do have the ability to set up what we would call a panel hearing, which is at least three members of the board, but less than a quorum. We would like to avoid doing that because that almost means we have to do double work because then the panel has to come back to the full board.
But we don't have to present anything today to do that. That's good.
Okay, we would not. So
that answers my question.
So at any rate, with Dee Dee's advisory attorney, and I'm head of advisory team on this, and we're talking with the chair about how we schedule all this. But I just want to make sure the board is aware that this is sort of one of those pigs through the python type thing that we have to work out, and we're hopeful that the worst case is that we would have 16, but that we would have much less by the time the dust was settled.
Yeah, and I might add that staff attorney worked hard with Bruce also and myself to figure out a way how we could handle this if we gang up with too many members because of everyone's busy schedule, but it's an obligation we have to do, and we're going to do it one way or another, so let's hope by then it'll be whittled down a little bit. Maybe we can get it all done in one day and maybe look at some of the other agenda items and see if we can float through a little bit there. So we're aware of that. Good question, Jim. Thank you for that.
And that's it for...
Okay, very good. So at this time, we will do the swearing in, please. It'll be all relevant evidence which any person's desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, secondly by the discharger, third by the public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, address, and whom he or she represents. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony which is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you. So moving on to Item 5, the consideration of uncontested. We have one note here, or one card, I'm sorry, for 5B, if we want to just pull that. I think it's just hopefully for good words, and it shouldn't take too long, so we want to go ahead and approve the uncontested item except for 5B.
Right. So I would suggest hearing 5B immediately after the uncontested calendar. I will note on item 5A that the order includes a map, it's figure one, and the copies you were mailed did not include that map. I've emailed those to you, and the official order does include that figure one map of the facility. With that, I'd recommend adoption of the uncontested calendar 5A and 5C.
So moved.
I will second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, I think we can all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So ordered, no opposition. Let's do 5B quick then, if we could, please.
Okay. As you have a card, and as the commenter comes up, I will note that we have one recommended change to 5B on page 15 of the order under provision 12. The due date says September 30th, 2015, and update annually. In this case, it's just a single one-time submittal, so the phrase "and update annually" should be stricken from that.
Okay, so we can just go ahead and, Mary Ann, you want to come forward, please?
Good morning, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Ian Ryan from Baykeeper. I just wanted to thank staff member Lindsay Whalen and the City of Berkeley for actively engaging Baykeeper in the review and revision process for this waste discharge requirement. And Lindsay was very happy to answer any questions we had, provide data, and actively incorporate revisions and comments that we had to the requirements. I just look forward to working with her in the future, and thought she should be commended for her efforts at stakeholder engagement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
This is a great Kumba day. Come back in May. We could save some of these, yes, board members.
Mr. Chairman, I serve as an appointed official in the Berkeley, City of Berkeley, on the Waterfront Commission. And any time something like this comes up that's under that provision, I have to look at whether or not my roles are compatible. So when this first came up at the City of Berkeley at the Waterfront Commission, I avoided all discussion of it except for the mandatory jokes about how you deal with ground squirrels. But I participated in no way with the City of Berkeley's decision or recommendation because I wanted to do this role. So I wanted to reveal that. I intend to vote on it unless somebody objects, but if somebody objects, I would happily recuse myself.
Seeing no opposition, we could got a knee banger. A motion, please, to...
I recommend adoption of the revised tentative order with the change to provision 12 on page 15 that I noted.
Second.
Moved and second with the staff's changes there. And at this time, all in favor, please?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So ordered, no opposition. And moving on now to
item 6 is
that was on the uncontested earlier, so now we go to 6.
Item 6 is hearing to consider adoption of a proposed basin plan amendment that would establish bacteria objectives. I'd like Richard Looker to make the staff presentation.
Okay. Good morning, board members. My name is Richard Looker, and it's good to be here this morning to tell you about a proposed basin plan amendment that we've prepared for your consideration. The proposed amendment will establish a new type of bacteria water quality objective in the basin plan for a bacteria called Enterococcus. The the objectives will apply to marine and estuarine waters in the San Francisco Bay region. So just to kind of orient you, that really means San Francisco Bay and Tomales Bay for our region, not the lakes or rivers or streams that we have. And I will be referring from time to time the water contact recreational beneficial use as REC 1. That's what it's called in the basin plan, so to avoid a mouthful throughout the presentation, sometimes I'll slip into that jargon, but we'll make do. So let's get started. On the right is a magnified view of the bacteria that we're dealing with in this project, Enterococcus. And you should kind of see a red flag that whenever a microbe has feces as part of its name, it's probably not a good actor. So I'm going to tell you more about Enterococcus in a moment. But let me start out by telling you what the scope of the project is. We have a fairly limited constrained scope in the project. We're just dealing with the Enterococcus objectives for contact recreation in marine estuarine waters. The need to add the Enterococcus objectives was identified as a high priority project in the last triennial review of the basin plan. And in order to address this priority need efficiently and expeditiously, we've limited the scope to just this for the time being. In a moment, I'm going to tell you about some comments that we received, and you probably read in your packet, about some commenters urging us to take on more in this project. And the other updates that are needed at some point are more involved, and more importantly, there are efforts underway at the state level and the federal level dealing with bacterial objectives that make it really not the right time to do a more comprehensive update now. But we are going to have to go there at some point when those other efforts are bearing fruit. Okay, so this amendment is about microorganisms, specifically bacteria. So it helps to begin to try to understand a little bit about bacteria and how we regulate them for protection of water quality. As a refresher, pathogens, or more specifically waterborne pathogens, are microorganisms like bacteria, viruses, and protozoa that can make you sick if you come into contact with water that contains them. Now, microorganisms, of course, are very tiny. So just to give you sort of an illustration to help understand, if you took a little blob of water, say about the size of a marble, and you were able to magnify it so that it was like the size of a big balloon, like 60 feet across, any protozoa that were in that water would look like about the size of a soccer ball. The bacteria in the water would look about the size of a peppercorn. And viruses would barely be visible and be about the width of a human hair. So even if you expanded this marble to the size of a 60-foot balloon, you know, these things are quite small. Waterborne pathogens almost always enter the water through fecal contamination from either humans or other warm-blooded animals. And common examples of such pathogens are listed here. Hepatitis, E. coli, Salmonella, Cryptosporidium, and Giardia are common examples. Now, waterborne pathogens make up a diverse group of organisms, and many of them are difficult to detect or impossible to detect in the environment because they're difficult to culture or appear in very low concentrations. So for this reason, what we do is we monitor and we regulate based upon so-called indicator bacteria. And pathogen indicators are chosen because they're easily identifiable, and they are found in the intestines of warm-blooded animals. And they can indicate the presence of fecal contamination and the potential presence of pathogenic organisms. So what they do is they act as sort of a tracer for all of the other organisms that would come from the intestines of warm-blooded animals, some of which can be dangerous. So examples of pathogen indicator bacteria are total coliform, fecal coliform, E. coli, and Enterococcus. Our basin plan already has objectives for total and fecal coliform, and up to now, we've been relying on those for our regulatory purposes, say, for example, in wastewater permits. E. coli objectives for freshwater are being considered by the state right now. That's one of those efforts that I told you about that's underway. And so today, we're establishing Enterococcus objectives for protection of the REC 1 beneficial use. Okay, so why Enterococcus? So basically, epidemiological studies or scientific studies have shown that of the indicators that are commonly available, this is the best one because it, for protection of REC1 because it correlates the best with the disease that's caused from contact recreation. And up to now, we've been relying on total coliform for this purpose, but Enterococcus has been shown to be better, so we're going to switch to that. The proposed Enterococcus objectives are already promulgated in the California Code of Regulations by the Department of Public Health for monitoring and notification and closure of beaches. And they're already in California's Ocean Plan, which applies to coastal waters, like outside the bay. And by adding Enterococcus objectives, this amendment will make our basin plan up to date for protecting REC1. Okay, so here's the proposed amendment kind of in a nutshell. There's five elements to it. I'm going to tell you more about each of these in a moment, but we have basically single sample maximum and geometric mean water quality objectives, a 30-day geometric mean effluent limitation for wastewater permits, a statement that requires mandatory bacteriological effluent limitations for any discharges that contain sanitary waste. We're going to provide limited flexibility to apply the total coliform effluent limit in place of Enterococcus, but in a very limited sense. And then we are going to have the ability to apply dilution to some water quality-based bacteriological effluent limitations. So let's look more detail at the elements. The principal regulatory element is the addition of a new single sample maximum and geometric mean water quality objective for Enterococcus to protect water contact recreation at REC1. So the numeric value of this single sample maximum, which is a value that a number should not be exceeded by any single sample, is 104 most probable number per 100 milliliters. So most probable number per 100 milliliters is the way that concentrations of bacteria in water are expressed. So you can just think of this in the same way that you think of, you know, an amount per volume. And I'm not going to get into the statistics how it's computed, but it comes from the artifact of how these things are actually measured in the laboratory, that they're expressed like this. But just think of it as a concentration. Then the geometric mean objective is 35 MPN per 100 milliliters. The geometric mean is a kind of an average, and this objective for this average applies for five equally spaced samples over a 30-day period. The geometric mean was derived from a regression model that related the disease that actually happens when you contact water containing the fecal material plotted against the concentration of the microbe in the water. And so they established this relationship, chose a particular risk level, and selected the geometric mean objective. Okay. And this objective, as I said, is consistent with the relevant sections of the California Code of Regulations, the Ocean Plan, and US EPA criteria. Okay, the second element is the implementation of the new objectives in wastewater permits. And we've chosen a straightforward means of implementing the objectives by taking the 35 MPN per 100 mil geometric mean objective and implementing it directly as a water quality-based effluent limitation. This is very straightforward. It's consistent with implementation guidance by the US EPA. And you may or may not know that this objective, or this effluent limitation, already appears in almost all wastewater permits already. So we're kind of making the basin plan, catching up so we can have a consistent basis for this effluent limitation going forward. The third element of the proposed amendment is that we have an explicit statement in the basin plan that says that for any discharge that contains sanitary waste, the discharges have to have mandatory bacteria effluent limits. Almost all facilities that are in this category already have these effluent limitations, but we want to have the basin plan have this explicit statement that reflects sound environmental policy and common sense. Okay, so even though nearly all the facilities will have Enterococcus effluent limits to protect REC1, The proposed amendment gives you, the board, limited flexibility to apply the total coliform effluent limitation in certain defined situations instead of the Enterococcus effluent limitation. The total coliform effluent limitation is what is currently in the permits. Most permits will have Enterococcus, but there are these circumstances where a facility is producing water for water reuse or reclamation, and they have permit requirements, or they monitor routinely for total coliform because the water reuse requirements are expressed in total coliform. So it's kind of more convenient for just a couple of facilities, maybe one or two, to continue having their effluent limits for total coliform. So we give you, the board, the flexibility to do that for these limited circumstances. Okay. The final element of the proposed amendment is that we give the board, you, the flexibility to apply procedures consistent with the State Implementation Plan, or SIP, to apply dilution credits for water quality-based bacteriological effluent limitations. This is consistent with the way that dilution is applied for other water quality-based effluent limitations that are in the permits. So we're going to provide this flexibility for bacteria as well, for just the water quality-based effluent limitations for bacteria. Water quality-based effluent limitations are those that are derived directly from a water quality objective, as opposed to, there's another type, technology-based. So this flexibility to apply dilution only applies to the water quality-based effluent limitations. Okay, so that's it for the amendment, just those five elements. The response to comments document in your agenda package contains our detailed responses to the comments we got from these six parties. And, of course, in this presentation, we're not going to go through every comment that we received, but we want to call your attention to three sort of flavors or themes that we saw in the comment documents. And two of those we discussed in the upfront section at the top of the response document, and I'm going to go over those for you, and also a third for you today. So the first sort of general theme that we saw that we want to talk about is that several commenters advocated enlarging the scope of this project to include a more comprehensive overhaul of bacteria objectives and effluent limitations. And the reason we decided to take on this project was that the technical work was clear-cut, it was available to us, that we could move efficiently to put in the Enterococcus objectives. And one of the main reasons we did not take on the more comprehensive overhaul is that I mentioned that there's these state and federal efforts dealing with other aspects of bacteria objectives, like at the state level for shellfish, and also for freshwater. And at the federal level, they're kind of doing a little bit of a rethink of bacterial objectives in general. And so we did not want to make changes to our basin plan at this time that would either duplicate those efforts or potentially conflict with those efforts. We know that we're going to have to revisit bacteria objectives at some point in the future, but we want to wait until these other efforts at the state and federal level bear fruit before we take that on. Okay, the next theme that we saw was that some commenters were not comfortable with our use of the highest tier single sample maximum, or SSM. They preferred us instead to use SSMs for varying level of water contact use, or to state that the single sample maximum only applied to beach closure or notification decisions. So these commenters have the worry that just using the highest tier as we proposed will either or both lead to unintended 303D listings or additional excessive cost for dischargers, like for instance for municipal stormwater discharges, in order to comply with that highest tier standard. Okay, so first, we don't have the option of establishing the SSM only for beach closure or notification decisions. There's another agency, the Department of Public Health, that already uses the single sample maximums for that purpose. So this would be duplicative of their authority, and we'd run into problems for that reason. Another reason is that US EPA has mandated that the states adopt both the geometric mean objective and at least one of the single sample maximums as an objective. So we don't have that option on the table to just use it for beach closure. Okay, so using the most protective tier, SSM, makes sense from a regulatory standpoint and will not likely lead to the negative consequences that were talked about by the commenters. And using this most conservative SSM, we feel has two virtues. One, it provides the highest level of protection for the water contact beneficial use because we're using the single sample maximum corresponding to the highest intensity of use. And two, we avoid having to sort out for everywhere in the region, in San Francisco Bay and Tamales Bay, what level of intensity of REC 1 is happening in all these locations. So this would be a difficult and time-consuming process. We would have questions about the accuracy, and it would have to be updated periodically as these use patterns change. So we feel that this effort is just not justifiable because there are no likely downside consequences for using the most protective tier as we proposed everywhere. When it comes to making water quality assessments for the purpose of 303D listings, we have to follow California's 303D policy, or the listing policy. And most of the data that we have for bacteria comes from heavily monitored, frequently monitored areas where we have enough data to use the geometric mean, and so we can rely on the geometric mean for making these assessment determinations. In areas where there's less frequent monitoring, we still have to follow the listing policy, which requires that we have a minimum of 5 samples, and for a sample size between 5 and 30, we would have to have 5 exceedances. And so if there are exceedances of the Enterococcus single sample maximum, it is very likely that there will be exceedances of other bacteriological indicator objectives as well. In other words, the impairment determinations will be based on evidence from all bacteria indicators and not Enterococcus alone, and certainly not the Enterococcus SSM alone. Any cost incurred by dischargers to reduce concentrations of bacteria would be motivated by the need to control all bacteria and not just Enterococcus. We really need to emphasize this. The Enterococcus indicator SSM by itself will not be a driver for either water body impairment determinations or requirements for additional control measures. Okay, the final theme that we saw in the comments that we'd like to bring to your attention is regarding our regulatory analysis. We got a comment that essentially claimed that our range of considered alternatives was not reasonable, our economics analysis was deficient, and we failed to analyze environmental impacts for reasonably foreseeable control measures for municipal stormwater discharges. We disagree with all of these, and let me take them one by one. So regarding the range of alternatives, for purposes of CEQA, we're not required to analyze every possible alternative. That would be impossible to identify. We're required to identify and consider a reasonable range, and that's what we did. Now, this commenter proposed a couple of additional candidate alternatives, and so in the response document, you see that we went ahead and analyzed them as well there. And after doing that, we still support our proposed alternative because it's the best fit for, considering the project objectives we have. And also, the candidates that were proposed by this commenter don't really lessen the potential negative environmental or economic impacts. So regarding economics, what we did in our report was appropriate for our circumstances. What we did is we analyzed basically unit costs for control measures that could be foreseeable. And what the commenter wanted us to do was put these together in combination to show how they would add up to a total cost for the region. And this is not really possible because extrapolating to get that kind of regional total is what we would do if we were doing a TMDL and we had specific information about the water body that was impaired and the watershed that contributed to that water body and what the loads of the bacteria were and what would be necessary to reduce those loads. So if you have that information, you can have you don't have to speculate on what would be required because you have a situation that's specific and concrete that allows you to develop an estimate. Doing it for the whole region now would require a lot of speculation that we weren't really willing to do. In the current circumstances, we're just establishing the objectives. We did not have all that information available for all possible impairments, so adding up those costs for the region is not possible. But one thing we can say is that we expect that costs to address bacteria impairments are likely to be the same regardless of which particular indicator is used to assess the impairment, whether it's Enterococcus or the others. So finally, we didn't really understand the commenter's claims that we did not analyze environmental impacts for municipal stormwater because the CEQA checklist that's an appendix to the staff report went into quite a bit of detail in terms of the analysis of these impacts. So we definitely didn't fail to do that analysis. Okay, so that's all I have. I just would like to conclude by saying that the proposed amendment will accomplish a necessary high priority to the update of the basin plan to add Enterococcus objectives and associated effluent limits. Many of the concerns expressed in the comments have to do more with what's not in the scope rather than what is, and they also concern unexpected consequences that we really don't think are likely to come about. We know that we have more work to do, and we will be back dealing with bacteria objectives and effluent limitations in the future, but now is not the appropriate time for that comprehensive overhaul because of these other efforts that are underway. We did make just a few minor clarifications to the basin plan amendment that you can note in your package. And with that, staff recommends adoption of the tentative resolution and proposed basin plan amendment as they appear in your agenda package, and we'd be happy to answer questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you. At this time, any questions of Richard? Otherwise, we do have a card, and I will say from my perspective, Richard, thank you very much for great presentation on a very technical item here from my perspective. So good job, and we will keep you nearby and talk to you more later.
While you have the commenter come up, you'll note we do not have a card from the US EPA.
Good morning, it's Naomi Fager with the Planning Division. This was sent to us by Diane Fleck. It says, good morning, US EPA Region 9 would like to make the following comments concerning the Water Board's proposed bacteria objectives for waters designated for contact recreation in marine and estuarine waters for San Francisco Bay Region. We regret that we are not able to be present in person and appreciate you allowing us to have these comments read into the record. US EPA is pleased to express our support for the proposed Enterococcus objectives of a geometric mean of less than 35 MPN per 100 milliliters and a no sample greater than 104 MPN per 100 milliliters for the water contact recreation beneficial use in marine and estuarine waters in Region 2. These objectives are consistent with the Beach Act of 2000 and EPA's November 2004 implementing regulations entitled Water Quality Standards for Coastal and Great Lakes Recreational Waters at 40 CFR Part 131.41. We expect implementation to be consistent with meeting the proposed objectives. We are pleased to see the board's proposed package and urge adoption. Thank you. Diane Fleck.
And it seems to me there was no new information other than supporting, is that correct, on that letter? So it's no
correct.
Big
right.
change and
nothing that we need to comment on.
Right. And so we'll let Ms. Amy Chastain come forward, please, and make comments. That's the only card I have on this item, so anyone else has intent to speak, need to fill out a card now.
If I'm the only card, maybe I can just go ahead and sit back down. good morning again, Chairman Mueller, members of the board. My name is Amy Chastain, and I'm the Executive Director of the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies. And, you know, I'm really just here to reiterate some of the statements that we made in our comments. One of the primary purposes or primary functions of POTWs, in addition to basic nutrient removal, but is disinfection of wastewater. And the adoption of this Enterococcus water quality objective actually helps us do our jobs. because it's more closely correlated with swimming-related illnesses. It means that we can better tailor the level of disinfection to both protect public health, but also minimize some of the related potential environmental human health implications of disinfection, such as the creation of chlorinated byproducts or the consumption of energy for UV disinfection. So I think that this is it's something that we strongly support, and we appreciate all of staff's time talking to us about what they were trying to accomplish with this objective. And we also understand their limitations in terms of not opening up the entire scope and looking at all of the bacterial objectives. And I really do, we all appreciate some of the changes that were made in response to some of the comments and the discussions that we had. I wanted to just reiterate kind of the three things that we did request. We do support the use of all, or the inclusion of all of EPA's water quality objectives or water quality criteria for the single sample Enterococcus standards. We think it just gives the water board and staff some flexibility in ensuring that REC 1 is protected, but then that it's protected at an appropriate level. We also still find that the implementation table is a little confusing. It's one of the few areas in the basin plan where we specify what implementation of those objectives is going to look like. And we had recommended that the board instead state that they will determine what implementation will look like by using the SIP and considering the appropriate circumstances for each discharge. And then finally, we did request explicit recognition that the fecal coliform standard to protect the shellfish beneficial use, that there be a clarification added to the table as to what the source of that standard is. It's very low. The I think it's the 5-day median is 14 for fecal coliform. And the single sample value is similarly low. And the source for this is the National Shellfish Sanitation Program and their model code guidelines, which you can view online. I'm happy to send them to you. They're also referenced in our comments. And those standards are intended to protect commercial shellfishing beds. So the point of having this discussion is just to point out that in this situation, that standard is not necessarily something that needs to be or should be adopted as is as a permit effluent limit. And this is the extent of our comments. We understand that the State Board is undertaking a process to deal with this, and I know that SCVRP down in Southern California has been doing work to look at kind of background concentrations for fecal coliforms in both the reference site and also in developed watersheds to help us understand how we can find an approach and develop an approach that's going to be flexible but still be very protective. So I think that staff's decision to not open up that can of worms at this time is appropriate, but I just wanted to make sure that you understood our perspective and kind of our thoughts on the issue. And I also want to thank staff for getting a copy of the Clean Marinas report that I prepared at Baykeeper, because I collected all those bacterial samples on my own, and it's nice to see that that data actually gets used in some way. So thank you.
Thank you. Board members, questions or comments? Board Member McGrath?
There's no further testimony on the question of... I've got to, before Amy leaves, I've just got to thank her for the clarity of her comments. As I was reading the packet, I came across the back of the letter, very clear, very well cited, tracked all the issues, and very clearly and persuasively written, and I really appreciate that. That helps. It helps us do our job. I do represent recreational users. I'm on the boards of Bay Access, which is kayaks and windsurfers, and San Francisco Board Sailing Association, which are windsurfers and kiteboarders. And I'm going to echo the staff's need for strong recreational protection and for the idea that you can't just identify where that happens. I windsurf. I don't kiteboard, but I find my colleagues both in kiteboarding and in kayaks in very strange places. They have an abiding interest in investigating the bay and doing tricks, in the cases of kites, flat water with a little bit of wind. They're in places that I never would have expected them to be, and I don't think it is a reasonable course of comments to say we need to find only heavily used beaches and limit it to that. I think in this, in terms of what's actually closed in the protection or the averaging process, there's ample consideration of how heavy the recreational use is. But I don't think it's reasonable to establish standards only for the most heavily used beaches. The recreationalists are out there even though I do it, I can't find all the places that they go. And then I wanted to comment a little bit on the comment letter from Morrison Forrester and the argument that, that there needed to be more CEQA review. One of the things that was missing in that letter was a clear indication of what they saw as the significant environmental impacts that, that they wanted alternatives to support. And as I understand CEQA, there need to be reasonably foreseeable significant environmental impacts that we're going to frame an alternative in order to try to avoid. I didn't see that in their comment letter, and I was fully persuaded by the staff that the likelihood of stormwater controls were going to come out of the totality of the permit that we have already issued, or new permits where consideration of significant environmental impacts could in fact go on. So I see nothing here that requires us, and I do believe I have a pretty thorough working understanding of CEQA and how it works. And then the final comment I have is monitoring really matters. Recreational users do make choices based upon it. They're in the water all year round in San Francisco Bay. They're in the water in storms to sail. They're in the water in storms and kayaks to play in places where there are big waves. And they do use information about spills and beach monitoring enclosures to make decisions. Sometimes they ignore them. And that's their choice. But this information is all valuable. So I find the staff presentation very persuasive for those reasons.
Well said. Thank you. Other board members? Vice Chair?
Yeah, I just wanted to second the comment that it's appropriate for us to consider the entire bay as a recreation area all year round. And it's I hang out with a lot of swimmers, and they're out there all the time, winter and summer, and not usually not at the beaches where you would expect them. So I think it's very appropriate for us to establish the level of protection that you're proposing here.
I couldn't agree more. I begin to wonder if it's a little salt water in the head sometimes, because recently we had a tsunami alert on the coast, and we all gathered together with our disaster preparedness like we should all be doing, which we forget to do. I was with the police chief, 17 surfers in the water at the harbor, and asked them to consider coming out of the water, and they go, oh no, if it comes, we'll just ride it out. So, you know, it's got to be a little impact of salt water whether you want to go into areas that are not as fresh as other areas. So, thank goodness, Jim, you're out there, because you're keeping an eye on all of that stuff for us. So we appreciate that.
Now remember, my objective on a windsurfer is to not fall and not get my face in the water.
I didn't know that, but yesterday coming back from Santa Cruz, let me tell you, there was some crashers out there with the windsurfer, with whatever they're doing. I don't know, but everyone slows to look at them, and you almost get in an accident because of traffic and not water-related issues. So, as I say, I don't take this lightly. It was a very, Naomi also, a lot of work everyone put into this. And I think this is a continuous way we're going in the direction of doing the right things for our water in the Bay Area here. So I don't see any other comments or questions. So go ahead for staff's recommendation. Already gotten.
I will note that typically when we have basin plan amendment, which includes TMDLs, that we have a testimony hearing and then respond to comments and an adoption hearing. Here we felt, because this was straightforward and we had a lot of comments that had come in that we were able to respond to, we were able to do that all at once and address both the testimony and the adoption in one hearing. The reason the chair is obviously making the point, did we hear any new comments, was that we're legally bound to respond to any comments, and essentially what's been presented are consistent with the written comments we've received to date. So with that, I do recommend we proceed to adoption. The tentative resolution includes as Exhibit A the basin plan amendment language. So by adopting the resolution, You essentially have that language included in the basin plan, and I'll note that the resolution directs me to transmit this to State Board, because again, this is one of those that needs, after your adoption, needs State Board approval, Office of Administrative Law approval, and US EPA approval. So with that, I'd recommend adoption of the tentative resolution you have in front of you.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? And in our swearing in, we can take additional written material for part of the record, so I guess we can accept EPA's letter, you know. Maybe they were at that reunion you were at. So, sorry about that. Have a roll call vote, please, Mary.
Mr. Eliade?
Aye.
Mr. McGrath?
Yes.
Mr. Schroeder?
Aye.
Dr. Singh?
Aye.
Dr. Bell?
Aye.
Mr. Miller?
Aye. So ordered. Thank you all very much.
Next item, item 7, is an information item on our settlement of litigation we've had with the U.S. Maritime Administration. David Elias will make a staff presentation on this. I'd also like to note that Tara Mueller from the Office of Attorney General and Chris Kerrigan from State Board's Office of Enforcement are here. They've worked with us on this. We had gotten late invitations out to some of the environmental groups, so not aware if they were able to attend to make comment. But
and they're sitting right up here in front for us to remember who they are again.
Yeah.
So nice seeing you, too. Thank you.
So with that, I'd like David to make our presentation.
Must be an inside joke going on with the the big guys here.
Thanks, Bruce. Thank you, Chairman Mueller and board members. I would like to say that I agree with you, Chairman Mueller, that these ships do have almost a palpable spirit. And despite the fact that I'm very pleased that we're going to have a lot less pollution, it is a little sad that we can't figure out anything to do with them. My name is David Elias. I work as an engineering geologist in the enforcement section and was part of the prosecution team for this recently resolved matter. As I'm sure most of you are aware, due to the recent news coverage, including TV coverage of Bruce at a well-attended press conference on March 31st, we have settled with the Maritime Administration with regards to the pollution problems at their Suisun Bay facility. The heart of the settlement is a consent decree, which will be enforced by Judge E. Burrell of the United States Eastern District of California Federal Court. And if he were enforcing my consent decree, I would follow it. I'll say that. During this presentation, I will take you from the beginning of the case in 2006 through 2017, when the final currently existing ship will have been removed from the fleet for scrapping and recycling. The fleet currently consists of 64 vessels. Six of the vessels are retention, which means that they may be activated for duty, while 52 of the vessels are non-retention, which means they will likely be removed from the fleet for dismantling and recycling. There have been as many as 57 non-retention vessels in the fleet during the history of our case. Six of the vessels are owned by the Navy or the Coast Guard and are slated for donation. In 2006, Thomas Peel, an investigative news reporter with the Contra Costa Times, discovered through a FOIA document review that in-water hole cleaning, which is intended to remove invasive species, was resulting in the discharge of large sheets of metal and paint to the bay. He reported this finding to our agency. Keith Lipton, my supervisor, followed up with informal enforcement requiring information submittals and a work plan prior to any future hole cleaning in the San Francisco Bay. These efforts did not result in substantive solutions to the in-water hole cleaning pollution problem. In 2007, we identified the Water Board's three main water quality concerns: the discharge of soluble and total metals during in-water hole cleaning, the accumulation of metals and sediments in the vicinity of the fleet, and the ongoing discharge of heavy metals-laden paint from the ships. We also started the formal enforcement process. We drafted numerous orders and subsequent notices of violation when MARA did not respond substantively to those orders. State Lands Commission, DTSC, and NOAA got involved with our efforts. Numerous coordinated comment letters were drafted and provided to MARA regarding these three main concerns. Senators Feinstein and Boxer and Representatives Tauscher and Miller wrote directly to MARAD regarding pollution from the fleet. In 2007, Thomas Peel again, through a FOIA review, encountered a MARAD report prepared in 2007 that documented the discharge of 20 tons of heavy metals to the bay and estimated that 60 tons of metals remained in the exfoliated and exfoliating paint remaining on the ships and lying on the decks. NRDC, Archaeology, and Baykeeper served their 60-day notice to sue to MARA for violation of both the Clean Water Act and RCRA in 2007. In 2008, with support from the State Board Office of Enforcement, and in coordination with the State Lands Commission at DTSC, we made a referral to the Attorney General's Office for representation. We were then pleased to be assigned Chris Kerrigan from the Office of Enforcement and Chris Tiedemann and Tara Mueller from the Attorney General's Office to represent us. With the support of Senator Boxer and Congressman Miller, NOAA received funds from Congress to complete some sediment investigation at the site. And in this year, we concluded that dry docking was the best available technology for cleaning of the ship bottoms, and that either dry docking or careful paint scraping and hydroblasting were appropriate for remediating the ship topsides. We pushed for those solutions in the absence of an effective in-water hole cleaning technology. And in August of 2008, we provided MARAD with our notice to sue in federal court. Subsequently, we drafted and submitted our complaint and intervened into the NRDC Archaeology Baykeeper lawsuit. In 2009, we moved forward with both settlement negotiations and litigation. We felt that if we delayed the litigation, it wasn't likely we would get a satisfactory settlement. This meant that we had to participate in discovery and complete depositions. We had to decide who would be segregated from the litigation as our expert witness. We determined that Keith Lichten would participate in the litigation solely as our expert, and I would continue to manage the case and report directly to Bruce. In 2009, we completed an inspection of almost every non-retention ship. All of the photos in this presentation were taken during that inspection, and the nicest ones were taken by another one of our engineering geologists, Laurent Mellier, who assisted with this enforcement effort. And in 2009, we worked on negotiating a consent decree, which went back and forth numerous times. In September 2009, Acting Maritime Administration Administrator David Matsuda took over, and he reached out to Bruce Wolfe. He clearly stated that MARA wanted to settle the case as soon as possible. For the first time, we believed that settlement rather than a trial might be possible. Also in 2009, for the first time, MARA agreed to complete hull and topside cleaning of two ships in dry dock prior to transport to Brownsville, Texas for recycling. In 2010, we all worked long hours to negotiate an acceptable consent decree. The consent decree has now been signed by the parties and submitted to Judge Burrell for his concurrence. What does the consent decree say? This year, MARA will submit a notice of intent to comply with the General Industrial Stormwater Permit and will submit a comprehensive pollution prevention plan, which has already been reviewed and approved by all of the parties. Within 120 days, they will remove the exfoliated paint from all of the ship decks. We expect this action to result in significant improvement in stormwater quality. In fact, as of April 9th, MARA reported that they had already cleaned the decks of 20 vessels and removed 140 tons of exfoliated paint. The picture above, behind you, is representative of the condition of many of the vessel decks with large volumes of accumulated exfoliated paint. By September 30th of 2011, MARAD will remove all of the exfoliating paint from both the vessel's horizontal and vertical surfaces from 25 of the worst vessels. This is a picture of one of the vessels being cleaned in dry dock at BAE Systems in San Francisco. Exfoliated paint will be removed from all of the vessels by September 30th of 2012. By September of 2013, 25 of the worst vessels will be removed from the fleet for scrapping. By 2015, MARAD intends to have removed a total of 44 of the vessels. By September 30th, 2017, MARAD is committed to removing all of the 57 currently moored non-retention vessels. New vessels may arrive, but they will arrive in good condition and will be maintained to minimize environmental impacts. Although we are very pleased to bring this litigation to a close with a positive outcome, we believe it's important to keep in mind that this result is only comparable to the work that thousands of local discharges are already completing at their facilities pursuant to the Clean Water Act. With little oversight on our behalf, the litigation was absolutely a significant drain on our staff resources. This is the first time this water board has litigated in federal court to enforce compliance with the Clean Water Act. Since we were successful, we believe that this action will serve as a deterrent to other would-be polluters in our region, and also perhaps set an example for other regions and other states who may be struggling with similar recalcitrance on the part of a federal polluting entity. Finally, I'm proud to say that our working relationship throughout this process with NRDC, Baykeeper, Arc Ecology, the Office of Enforcement, and the Attorney General's Office could not have been more positive and productive. Our hope is that this success will be duplicated in the future and that we can continue to work closely together to improve and protect the waters of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent, excellent. Board Member Singh?
Thank you. How many retention vessels will be left after 2017?
That's difficult to say.
57 non-retention vessels will be removed by 2017.
The consent decree only applies to 57 of the vessels. We are not we cannot address vessels that are not currently in the fleet through this process. We'll continue to do that through the water code. So we hope that there will be much fewer vessels there. They're not prohibited from bringing new vessels into the fleet. However, the vessels that do come into the fleet, non-retention, will be in much better condition and will be maintained. And if they aren't maintained, they know we're serious about making sure that they're maintained. So we don't anticipate that's going to be an issue in the future.
And I'll just add that on the retention ships, those are still owned by either the Navy or the Coast Guard and do receive funding for maintenance. So those have not been at issue here because those essentially are in good condition. It's those ships that once they pass in ownership to the Maritime Administration, up until now, the Maritime Administration has put no money into their maintenance.
And so that's why they end up in the condition we've seen. Now they will need to do that. So we're less concerned about the retention ships that may still be out there.
Yeah, board member.
The Iowa is one of the retention ships. The idea of the retention fleet is that conceivably those are ships that could come back into active service or have, like the Iowa, have historical value.
Good. I will say that, again, thank all of you very much for many, many hours. And I know the legal people work really hard with the lawyers back and forth on this for many years, really and truly, in the Obama administration with their, that was hard for this guy to say, but did a very good job to get this settled. And David was just a wonderful appointee to become administrator, in my opinion. And he was very enthused about all the things that we're doing and kind of new to it all for and all of his staff. And I think he got a lot of lessons from everybody involved in this. And as Bruce was there, and as we all heard our vice president with the signing of the health care, it was a big whatever deal. Bruce commented it was a big wow, I believe it is. And I've been trying to figure this out the last weeks here. And if you turn it upside down, it was mother. What was
your Christian belief? Comment that it was sort of wow, but you could turn wow over and it's mom. And of course, your mother's always telling you to clean up your room. And in effect, we've been telling the Maritime Administration to clean up their mess.
We don't want to hear the old speech, but we know it's all.
Finally, we've gotten there, they are cleaning up their room.
Yes, no, they definitely are. So that's the wow, it's mom and clean out. So.
But I think another wow was, as David said, that through the first 20 ships, they've already removed 140 tons of paint and other debris just on the tops of the ships. So that early estimate of 60 tons that may be possible is definitely low. And without controls, obviously all that material has the potential to get into the bay. So this is clearly a significant action that they're taking.
And I think with...
Let me make a comment here that in India, whenever we play football over here, we call it soccer, the winning team, at the end of the play, we say hip hip hooray. So yeah. That's what to you, the team, I will say hip hip hooray.
Thank you. And I think for all of us... Western Bay people, we learned a lot from board member Schroeder with his associates and his contacts with Representative Miller. You've got a great friendship there and a lot of dear friends from the East Bay people, and it's very valuable because we have a little bit on the West Bay, but she doesn't have time for us too much. But thank you for all those contacts that you've made with them over the years too.
I will note, right, we have had a good relationship with the congressional delegations on this, and there's been less involvement from the state legislature, but Senator Wiggins has been involved, and I just had a call this week from their district director that they're pushing to get the old dry docks at Mare Island up and running as potential disposal. And
that was a dredging issue with
and
us.
We're about to issue our water quality certification to allow the dredging there. There's still other agencies that need to act. You may recall that in 2008 you issued a permit to the group Applied Defense Recycling that is proposing to do the ship recycling right there at Mare Island. That's not necessarily a full solution because the dry docks are small with just two of them. They expect to have a throughput of 4 to 6 ships a year, but certainly that'd be more efficient than towing them all the way to Brownsville, Texas, where that's the nearest location at this point.
$1 million a tow plus.
This definitely is getting interest. I have a delegation from Ireland coming to meet with us next week who says they have a new and improved process to dispose of the ships, and they want to get our support, and so we'll hear them out. But we've got the process in motion to move forward, and as
you say, it's been a long haul, and we're glad we've got it down on paper. Now the work starts with getting it done in action.
I also have a meeting next week with the facility folks to get really ramp up the cleaning of the ships using other techniques besides brooms and shovels. So
it was a day to be proud to be a board member.
I think almost every day you're proud to be a board member. Really and truly.
I'm pleased to hear you say that.
Yeah, we've all come a long way, baby. Yeah. We're able to put our toes in the water, not like your trips you two had. So so I think that concludes. This was information only, so thank you all. And here, if you have 1 minute, would you stay and visit with me for 1 second? I'm going to work you on something else here. So,
with
Coastal.
That, yeah. There is no closed session, and as I say, we'll keep you posted on schedule.
Be prepared for May.
Dad, you were easy with this month.
Thank you.